Before the parties start, I just want to let you know that we have an order to appoint title for GAL for party submitted recently, and I want to make sure that there is a formal supplementation of the record so that it's clear that this is within it.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well. Please tell us who you are.
May it please the court, my name is Stephanie Beach, here on behalf of appellant Sharon Lane. We are asking the court to reverse the entry of the CR2A agreement and all contingent orders as it was entered without the permission and agreement of Sharon Lane. I'd like to focus on what I think both parties can agree is the central issue in this case, and that being, does the litigation guardian ad litem have the right to waive her client's right to a trial?
Well, before you get there, because I think in looking at this, you've just laid out the event that we need to look at, which is the two-way agreement, correct?
Correct.
So there are certain requirements that need to be met in order for a 2A agreement to be effective.
That is correct.
So can you address why 2A was not met?
2A was not met. So if in order to enter a 2A agreement, there must be agreement from both the parties, and that must be sent to either in writing, signed by both of the attorneys, or on the record.
But isn't it attorneys or parties?
That is correct.
So the record's clear that Ms. Lane's attorney, Mr. Gibson, did not sign.
That is correct. He did not sign the CR2A agreement.
So then we are looking at party.
That is correct.
And the record is clear that Ms. Lane strongly objected.
Yes.
And did not sign. So then the question is, did the GAL, the LGAL, have the authority to enter into this 2A agreement on behalf of Ms. Lane?
That is correct, Your Honor. And we would assert that no, she did not have that authority.
So rather than looking at cases elsewhere, if we look simply at the order that appointed Ms. Lane, can you address whether that order gave Ms. Lane, I'm sorry, the LGAL, can you address whether that order appointing the LGAL gave the LGAL the authority to enter into that 2A agreement on behalf of Ms. Lane?
I can, Your Honor. So Ms. Lane was appointed an LGAL pursuant to what's called Title IV, RCW 4.08.060. This statute is fairly minimal. All it says is that the incapacitated person shall appear by a guardian.
If I understand correctly, the initial order, and I think that's the order that Judge Cox was referring to, although designated, did not make it to us. And so it is the order to appoint Title IV GAL for party. Although designated by you, we do not have that.
Oh.
Well, you don't have to. You just have to supplement the record later.
Certainly, Your Honor, we will do that.
So that order said that the Ms. Gillum was appointed, and she was to report back as to whether the court should consider an appointment under RCW 4 or under RCW 11.
That is correct, Your Honor. And she was appointed under RCW
4.
Does
that make a difference?
It does, Your Honor.
And why?
So RCW 4, like I said, is a very minimal statute. All it says is that the incapacitated person shall appear by a guardian. Incapacitated is not defined. There's no procedures listed, no guidance on how guardian is supposed to be appointed. You have to look at case law for that.
Well, but before we look at case law, let's look at the order. So here we have the court does appoint the LGAL under Title IV, and the order says that she shall have the full authority to act on behalf of Ms. Lane for her best interest with regard to any issue arising under the litigation, and confer with Ms. Lane's counsel and provide counsel with authorization needed to effectuate her best interest. So does that order give her the authority to enter into this agreement?
No, it does not.
Why?
Because the procedures that are in place to appoint a guardian, the due process procedures up to that point, are insufficient to allow a guardian to waive a substantial right, such as a right to have claims adjudicated on the merits. No, I'm not challenging that, Your Honor.
Because I think what Judge Schindler wants to know is whether the words in the order on their face would give the legal guardian ad litem the authority to sign a CR2A agreement. A separate question is whether the court could grant that guardian that authority.
Well, the order, all it says is full authority, and that's not defined. And in order to look at what full authority is, that's where you need to look to case law. And the standard for appointing.
So what does the case law say? And let's look just at Washington.
Sure. The case law, so you have Questnell, Houts, Elmore Welfare of HQ. All of those statutes, or all those cases, I'm sorry, say that a guardian ad litem cannot waive the substantial rights of the ward, regardless of whether they're appointed after, before or after a finding of incapacity.
So the court, in its written ruling, the court references appointment under 4.08060 as interpreted by Blakely and cites that case. So what does Blakely tell us?
So Blakely tells us Blakely tells us that a guardian is appointed if the court is reasonably convinced that the litigant is not competent to understand the significance of the legal proceedings.
So it doesn't say anything about authority.
It doesn't say anything about authority. It has to do with how a guardian is appointed and the difference between Title 11 and Title 4 guardians is what Blakely is about.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Craig Hansen representing Mr. Lane. There is one procedural question, and one is that I don't know if the court wants to hear from GAL or not, who's here prepared to talk. We just had no idea.
Well, we have 10 minutes, so you use your time as you best think it should be used.
We think the order that the court signed absolutely gave Ms. Gilliam the authority to settle the case.
The case.
I think it does under the statute, Your Honor, and certainly under the case law. If you go back to look at Roop versus Robinson, the court seems to say a litigation GAL is appointed with authority to do whatever needs to be done in that.
How do you reconcile that with the cases that say that the guardian cannot waive a substantial right?
Then you have to go back and consider what a substantial right is, and then you get to the balancing test of Matthews. I think it is a substantial right, or it's certainly a right. Whether it's a right that's so substantial it cannot be waived depends on the balancing test and what the different factors are.
We're not talking about waiver here, are we? Ms. Lane didn't ever purport to waive her right to consent.
The question is whether or not the litigation GAL can waive Ms. Lane's right to a trial.
That's a little circular. The question is, can a court give a guardian ad litem the right to settle a case? And in analyzing whether it can or not, the first question is the right to settle a case, a substantial right. I think we can agree that settling a case affects substantial rights of a litigant in a marriage dissolution proceeding.
It absolutely does. But
so given the case law that seems to say the guardian ad litem cannot be given the authority to settle or to waive a substantial right of a party, how can the court grant a legal guardian ad litem the right to settle a case?
Because then the court would have to decide that the right to a trial is not so substantial that the litigation GAL cannot settle a case.
Is there any case law that you're aware of that says that the right to trial lacks the status of being a substantial right?
There's no case that I'm aware of in Washington that says that the right to trial is so substantial a right in a divorce that it cannot be waived. Or that
it's a divorce as opposed to a contract dispute?
With respect to a contract dispute, perhaps not. We were looking at cases in terms of dependency. The case law in Washington with litigation GALs that we had looked at primarily revolves around dependency.
Well, dependencies involve parents' rights to children, and dissolution proceedings do as well. Dissolution proceedings, if we had a continuum, dissolution proceedings would appear to be closer, at least with respect to parenting plan provisions, to dependencies than contract disputes.
That's true to a degree, Your Honor. I would point out, under Gourley, for example, protection orders and restraining orders also affect a parent's right to their children, and those are routinely granted without a right to a trial. And the court in Gourley has held that...
Those are temporary orders, right?
But they can also... But the order... The family law commissioner or the family law court on a petition to renew an order of protection can renew it and make it permanent without the person having a right to a trial.
Isn't there a point before a restrictive order becomes permanent to an evidentiary hearing with the right to call live witnesses?
Where that line is, I can't tell you, Your Honor, but I'm sure there is at some point under the case law here. I think that's a little bit vague. I think under protection orders, Gourley does not seem to say that there is an absolute right to a trial at some point. I do think...
Do you think Morrissey versus Brewer does?
I can't tell you that, Your Honor.
It strikes me that the state Supreme Court just came down with a decision that said that the SLAPP statute cut against the right to jury trial here in the state of Washington. I'm just wondering if that case has some impact on what we're discussing here.
It may well, Your Honor. I have not briefed that, and I have not looked at that, so I can't tell you.
Okay.
I do think...
Well, is a litigant's right to have a dispute decided by a court a constitutional right?
It is a constitutional right, but then you get back to the balancing test in Matthews, where you're balancing off the different factors.
Okay, well, Matthews addresses what due process requires. What we're trying to decide here, I think, is whether this is a substantial right. And if it's a constitutional right, it would seem to be substantial.
But I think we would argue that a substantial right depends on the context of the case.
Is there a case that says that?
I'm not aware of one, Your Honor, but the courts certainly treat the right to trial and due process in different ways depending on what the context of the case is.
I thought we just established there was a right to trial on the issues in this case and that it stems from due process.
That's correct. But whether or not it is so substantial as to say the litigation GAL...
I've never seen a case that talks about a continuum of substantial rights. Either it's substantial and it can't be waived, or it's not substantial and the guardian of life can waive it. Do you have any case authority in Washington for this continuum of substantial rights you're describing?
When we look at the case in Matthews, what Matthews seems to say is, although it's you cannot waive a critical... critical liberty interest without a substantial countervailing interest, you still have to balance it off against the other.
You're back into the due process world, and I'm into a different world. The world I'm in is the Supreme Court has circumscribed the authority of court-appointed guardian ad litem. And that it doesn't say it's doing that for due process reasons. It just says you can't do it.
Your Honor, we would argue that in the case of a litigation GAL, that the court can give the litigation GAL authority to settle the case. In order to do that, you have to be able to sign.
Well, shouldn't that authority have been specific then? In other words, when the court enters an order that talks about the authority of the LGAL, shouldn't the court have specifically addressed that?
I think when the court says full authority, it means full authority, because inherently...
Well, it's full authority to act on behalf of Ms. Lane in her best interest. But that doesn't mean that necessarily she had the right to waive Ms. Lane's substantial right to litigate the concerns she had.
But inherent in that full authority to pursue the case is you have to make decisions on what claims to pursue, what claims not to pursue, what claims are worth pursuing. You have to be able to compromise.
I think the case law makes a distinction between procedural, the authority of the GAL related to procedural matters versus substantive matters.
Well, the other reality is, Your Honor, if the court says that you cannot waive a right to a trial, and therefore an incapacitated person has to agree to a settlement agreement every single time, what that means is you can't ever actually settle a case.
Well, might that not be what's appropriate? Because otherwise we have a guardian ad litem making factual determinations that a person normally would have the right to have a court make, and we're taking that right away from that person because of a lack of capacity.
Well, and it's a lack of capacity to understand the proceedings. We're not under a Chapter 11 guardianship.
But you're still, when you took it at a lack of capacity, it's in this case, it's clear it was a lack of capacity to deal with the proceedings, but it's also a lack of capacity to fully understand what the claims actually
well, so
are.
The couldn't the trier of fact take that into account during the course of the proceeding in front of it, where there's the presentation of evidence?
It can, but then you get that due process problem.
Isn't that why we want someone like a judge making those decisions, where the person who's significantly affected lacks the capacity to both understand the process and perhaps the substance of the process, rather than a lawyer? I mean, we have certain powers that we only give to judicial officers. Isn't this of that nature?
But then... To some degree it is, Your Honor, and to some degree I think you have to balance it against the purpose of appointing a litigation GAL, where you're trying to have somebody act in the best interest of the incapacitated person to avoid wasting estate assets, to avoid wasting judicial time, to make decisions that are in the best interest of that person cannot make.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
To address a couple questions that were posed by Judge Leach, yes, there actually is a case in Washington that states that full access to the courts in a divorce is a fundamental right, and the case citation for that is Bullock v. Roberts, 84 WN2D 101.
Is that a fee waiver case?
I'm not entirely sure on that. I believe it is, though, Your Honor.
But... I think we've already heard there's a concession. It is a substantial right.
That is correct, Your Honor.
In this case.
Counsel here addressed briefly Roop v. Robinson. What actually happened in Roop was that this was also a divorce action, and the woman in question had both a guardian and a guardian ad litem. Her husband, who was suing for divorce, was her guardian. And the question was...
Title 11 guardian?
But this was in 1926. But what would be functional equivalent of a Title 11 guardian?
So is your argument as distinguishable?
It is distinguishable in that case was about conflict of interest and who, between the Title 11 guardian and the Title 4 guardian, had the right to control the litigation. So it wasn't about the Title 4 guardian's authority and the extent of her authority. It was about whether the Title 11 guardian could do anything contrary to the Title 4 guardian.
Is that because the husband could control both sides of the issue?
That is correct, in which case there would be a conflict of interest and divorce would not be granted. The same is true for the Miller case, which was also cited in Dill. Now, as far as
what do you mean the same is true?
For Henry Miller, that case was also a situation where you had a Title IV GAL and a Title XI GAL, and which one had the authority.
Thanks.
As to Judge Cox's question about the anti-SLAPP statute, or the anti-SLAPP case, Davis v. Cox, that case doesn't directly apply here, but I think what that case shows us is that when you look at whether somebody has a right to access to the courts, you can't look at
That was all about a jury trial.
It was.
So, I mean, I did look at that, but I didn't think it was useful because the court was so focused on the right to a jury trial.
That is correct. although I would argue that there is also a right of access to the courts, which was discussed in depth in Putnam, and that also deals with discovery.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our